This is Radio Freethinker, episode 80.
One, two, one, two, three, four. We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there's still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody needs somebody.
Someone to love,
sweetheart to miss,
sweetheart to miss,
sugar to kiss,
sugar to kiss.
I need you, you, you. I need you, you, you. I need you, you, you. In the morning,
you, you, you.
When my soul's on fire.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC, and our special guest.
Hi, Chloe, member of UBC Freethinkers and creative writing student here at UBC.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us, Chloe. So, we were playing the Blues Brothers, and there's a good reason we played the Blues Brothers, because they're a very diverse band. And that's what we're going to be talking about today on Radio Freethinker, diversity in the skeptical movement. Isn't that right, Chloe?
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
You know, before we started our show this week, you know, I just wanted to give ourselves props, because the power of this podcast, this radio show, has changed the world, or at least in part, because I'm sure it's because of our episode last week where we talked about the Bible, the Koran burning in Florida that stopped them from doing it. I'm sure somebody must have listened to it and spread the word, but it stopped. He didn't do the Koran burning, and I'm sure we can all take a slight bit of credit for that. Props, guys.
Thank you, I will.
Is it actually true that some people put their hands on the grill so that they couldn't put the Koran on it?
No.
They were probably courageous Radio Freethinker listeners.
Yes. I'm sure all of us did. But, you know, I thought it was quite funny the way this worked out, because while I was doing sort of post-show research, I found out that in South Africa, actually, the South African court had to burn a similar instance. There was a gentleman who's named Mohammed Vauda, who apparently is not as good a Muslim as you might think, had planned to burn Bibles in the Johannesburg Center Square in protest to this Koran burning. It was Burn Bible Day, and it was, like I said, intended to react to this Terry Gerald, or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
But it was the court ruled it was illegal, stopped him from passing an injunction, said you can't do it. Now, there's an irony to this, of course, because Islam is evolved out of Christianity and Jewishness, and it's part of the Judeo-Christian concept of religion. So actually the Bible, parts of the Bible, parts of the Torah, are also sacred texts to Muslims. So burning the Bible actually is offensive to them as well. I thought that was interesting. But there was one thing that came out of this that kind of bothered me a bit, is the reason that the court gave for banning the burning, which, again, I'm all for burning, because this was a sort of a hate crime in my books. But they didn't say it was a hate crime. In fact, for them, they said the court had ruled that it was illegal to burn any text considered sacred in a religiously diverse South Africa. So I'm not quite sure if I think that just because someone thinks it's religious, it should get a pass on that. I mean, like I say, if you were burning it saying, I hate brown people, therefore we're going to burn the Koran, or I hate Italians, we should burn the Bible, yes, that qualifies. But just because a text is considered sacred by someone, I don't know if it should give it innately special status.
So how do they define sacredness here?
Well, yeah, good question. I'm not quite too sure. Anyone out there who has any old Greek textbooks that might have the story of the Iliad or Odyssey might be careful if you tried to burn them for whatever reason. Because
there could be pagans there.
There could be Greek pagans out in the world or whatever. In fact, there was an interesting parallel. Some Korans were actually vandalized and burned on 9/11 in New York or whatever. There was one gentleman named Reverend Bob Old, what a name, and Daniel Allen, who burned Korans in their Tennessee backyard, which, I don't know, that just I could just see them in front of their barbecue going, how are we going to start this thing? I don't know. You got anything? No. Oh, yeah, I got this. Okay, throw it on there, and we'll start a... but it's funny, the excuses that they use, they said, we have a... you have to have the right book behind you. This is a book of hate, not of love. Therefore, we're going to burn it. it just, I don't know. Another one who did something in Washington said, part of the reason why we're doing what we're doing is to confront the charade that Islam is a peaceful religion. Now, of course, this is an anti-abortion guy, partly related to some of the violence that's associated with that particular movement. But again, out of all this hatred and nuts, someone says something that I'm going to say, well, you know, hold it. This is maybe a bit more complicated than we'd like to take on first thing. One person had said that if you can burn the American flag, then I can burn the Quran. America should not be afraid to give their opinion. Now, again, you know, most people may not remember whatever, but it was a huge thing in the 70s and 80s over flag burning. Can you burn the American flag? And it was huge, huge, considered sacred, considered American sacred. You're not allowed to do it. So I don't know. You know, part of me says, you know, I believe in hate crimes, and I think 99% of the people who wanted to burn the Quran did it as a hateful act. But does that mean, I mean, how do we parse this?
Well, how do you determine when somebody is doing it out of spite and hate and when someone is trying to make a pointed political statement on freedom of expression?
I think this comes back partly to the issue of sanctity. I mean, we need to give something value, and when it has value, then when you burn it, it's problematic. Like bra burning in the 70s, of course the woman's going to say that.
I'm glad we have such diversity on the show.
Such diversity. I've never burned a bra. I'm sure someone would find that offensive. Anyway, I'm sorry, going back to your question, which was...
So how do we determine if someone is being a jerk and just like, I'm going to burn this because I'm going to piss someone off, versus someone who's trying to make a very, I think, important statement that is, freedom of expression should not be trumped by someone potentially being offended by you. So, you know, burning the flag, burning the Quran, burning any book, really. You know, if I decide to burn, you know, a computer Daniel loves, you know...
No, not my computer.
Not your computer, but a computer. You know, like...
Well, maybe I can parse it here.
Okay.
Because we talked about this before. The idea in South Africa, they said sacred text.
Sure.
Right? So when is burning something because it's a sacred text wrong, whereas burning something because it incites hatred...
Hmm.
Right, and so that's so. If you want to burn something because it's sacred and you want to make a statement about that, I have no problem. I think that everyone shouldn't even be afraid to do that.
Hmm.
Whereas if you're burning something in order to elicit hatred, because you know it's not because it's sacred, it's just because I know it's going to offend these people, or I know it's going to cause hatred of these people.
Well, that seems nice on paper, but as Ethan was saying, how do you tell that? Like. The problem that almost all hate crime laws have had in the past is, what are the evidentiary rules for what constitutes a hate crime? Mm-hmm. Does the person have to, like, come out so explicitly stated, I am burning these Qurans so violence erupts and people die? Do they have to do that before it's considered a hate crime? What if they just burn it and internally it's because of that, but they never say it? There's no way of proving it.
And there's also the issue of who's doing the burning. For example, if, say, Dawkins decided to burn some Bibles, from our perspective as skeptics, we probably think that's more of a political statement. But for a religious person, they'll interpret that as a hate crime, right?
Yeah.
Same with, like, you know, someone like Sam Harris, who is pretty critical of Islam. If he were to burn the Quran, it might have a different meaning to us, but not necessarily to anyone who's a Muslim.
I think one of the ways that you can parse that question, and again, it's rather delicate, but a lot of the rhetoric out there is that Muslims are out to get America. Islam is out to get America. Whereas it's like, you know, either A, Dawkins will say religion is evil,
mm-hmm.
or that the Quran isn't necessarily a good book, right? I mean, one of the things that struck me as some of the people who were supporting this is how many times the word hatred came out in it. And I mean, for me, that's a red flag, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not something we would use. And again, we have to be careful as atheists. If I say the Pope promotes hatred and we should kill all Catholics, I think I've crossed the line from being a political statement to eliciting hate against religion. And it is. It's a delicate balance. It's not a simple issue.
Well, anyone else have any thoughts on this delicate issue?
How do you burn a MacBook?
Well, I think you'd probably just throw it onto the fire.
Thermite, but please don't.
But does it, like, melt and then reform itself like the Terminator does?
I don't think Steve Jobs has got there quite yet.
But he will. That's the next one.
I think that's an advancement in science. And, you know, speaking of science...
Speaking of science, Don, we're always speaking of science. But did you know that science is under siege here in Canada?
Isn't science pretty much always under siege?
That's true, actually. But under the current Harper...
The latest salvo.
Yeah, the latest... Yeah, sure. Under the current Harper government, federal scientists must now seek permission to talk to the media about scientific matters. This has actually kind of exploded onto the scene in the last little while. I've gotten about a dozen emails about this already. It's floating around all the skeptical blogs here in Canada. What this means is that if you're a scientist working in Canada and you're employed by the federal government, perhaps you're working for the Natural Resources of Canada, and you have a new discovery you want to publicize, you have to seek pre-approval from the minister. In this case, for the Natural Resources, it would be Minister of Natural Resources, Christian Pardis, for example, to get permission to speak with national or international journalists. What do you think of that?
Does this apply to researchers who have just accepted government grants, or only ones that are, like, on the payroll of the federal government?
That is unclear at the moment. I presume that it's anybody who is getting funding via the government, ultimately from the taxpayer.
That's a lot of researchers. I kind of doubt it'll be the ones under grants. I think probably just directly hired by them. But even still, it's...
I think one of the things that's scary about this, and a misunderstanding, is I'm assuming one of the justifications, and you're alluding to it, Daniel, is that if you are an employee of someone, then they have a certain amount of rights to restrict your activities. But government employees are employees of the government and not of Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party. And in that sense, I don't think they should be innately accountable in that sense of it. I mean, they're going to be accountable because, I mean, they got the job, they got the funding. So, I mean, there's going to be repercussions for what they do, but I don't think they should be on the same political page as the Harper government just because.
Exactly. And the other issue is, what happens if these scientists are working on contentious issues that certain governments may have political or ideological policy about?
For example?
Well, for example, let's say climate change, stem cell research, or even harm reduction drug policy. These are issues that are highly politicized, and if these scientists have to go to government officials to ask permission to publicize this research, that could be really handicapping them.
Well, actually, you know, and it's even worse than that if you think about it. I mean, one of the things that we would term the sort of crazy skeptics is that there's some big conspiracy and you can't trust government scientists, you can't trust these scientists because they all have a bias. Well, this is just feeding right into that.
I mean,
if you sit there and we wanted to do a discussion about the tar sands, for example, or something like that, right? Well, we would hope that we would at least have objective information on there. But if this goes through, we no longer have the objective information. How are we allowed to make informed decisions or judgments?
Let's not go quite that far. All it's saying so far is that they're not allowed to publicize it to media outlets as much. They're not saying that they're going to actually put control over the science aspect of it.
Well, no.
Among science journals.
What I'm unclear about is, does this mean that they have to get permission to publicize it anywhere or just to talk to a journalist about
it? Well, let me answer your questions with an example that's already happened. There was a situation where a scientist published a paper in the journal Nature, and he was not allowed to do any interviews with science journalists, or he wasn't allowed to communicate with any media about his article. Now, I mean, you think, okay, well, this has got to be something big. It's got to be like climate change or stem cells. No, actually, it was a study about a colossal flood that swept across northern Canada 13,000 years ago. This was deemed too sensitive for this journalist to talk about to the media.
Do you know why?
Why?
I hope I'm wrong in this, but there was no Earth 13,000 years ago. Exactly. Everyone knows the Earth was created 6,000 years.
We would naturally assume, I suppose. The tragedy of this case, I mean, was that this scientist, by the time that he got permission to talk to the media, the story was over. You know, journalists have deadlines, and when deadlines pass, they move on. Further, you know, they can just go to different scientists in different fields and get prompt response. So this Canadian scientist gets left in the cold for research that he did. Now, these regulations that prevent Canadian scientists from interacting with the world scientific community, they're going to hamper Canadian institutions as well. So if you're a scientist, is there an incentive to work in Canada if your efforts aren't going to be promoted and respected fairly with your peers, say, in America or Europe?
You know, and actually that also goes with another theme that's been going on in the science community, is the necessity for scientists to become more of advocates of science, more popularize it, because the anti-science type people are loud and in your face, and that needs to be met with corresponding people promoting the scientific method, promoting real research. And this would strike me as to be somewhat of a handicap. Even if they do get to publish their articles in scientific papers, they don't get to give the proper interpretation of that to the mass media. So when we read the Georgia Strait and they say there's a cure for cancer as long as you buy our vitamin D product or something, well, if you can't actually talk to a scientist who did the research, assuming it was a government scientist, then the crazies get to do their thing and you don't actually get the word from the mouth, from the science's mouth.
Right. And then we kind of touched on this already, but the issue of ownership of the science itself. Now, the person funding this research is the Canadian taxpayer. And if the Canadian taxpayer can't get access to the research being done, that strikes me as kind of theft to a certain degree. We're not being allowed to get firsthand knowledge from the scientist of the research they're doing that is being funded by Canadian taxpayers. And if this research is pivotal to Canadians' lives, you know, we talk things about, like, the oil sands, for instance. If they're doing research on contamination of Alberta water supplies from the oil sands, and this information is not publicized adequately, that could constitute a public risk.
Well, let's flip it around. Let's pretend it's the exact opposite. Let's say there was someone out there who said the tar sands is a great project, that global warming is false, not really true. He happened to be a government scientist, and he wants to publish this, and we happen to have a more saner government who says, no, you can't do that because that's just not proper.
Right.
So, I mean, like, right now, we've been casting this as if the government's trying to suppress bad science, which I think there's a historical precedent for that.
Sure.
But isn't it possible to argue that, well, they could also be suppressing, you know, people who would misuse their position to promote what we would consider to be bad science?
And that's what you were kind of saying earlier with the whole umbrella of the conspiracy theory. This person can then go, you know, and legitimately say, my research was prevented by the Canadian government from being released. And that's not a good thing, you know, like, we don't want to give them more fiery material to throw at us that we're part of this big, you know, big pharma, big corporation, weirdo environmentalist movement.
If I'm understanding you correctly, you're sitting there saying that if people are open and discuss their opinions in a public forum, and everyone's allowed to do that equally, that overall, the more scientific method will prove itself out because it's reproducible, it's provable. So even if you do have the occasional bad scientist promoting something, that will in the long term be overrun as long as everyone gets to say their piece.
Yes, we have this thing called the scientific method, and it's a really great tool for allowing bad ideas to be exposed for bad ideas that they are, and good ideas to be promoted and enjoyed by everybody.
Can you buy the scientific method from Radio Freethinker?
It's free.
What?
That's right.
Wow. How can we afford to give it away?
Yeah, exactly. I want to close with a quote here. This is from Andrew Weaver, who's a climatologist at the University of Victoria. And he wrote that there is no question that there is an orchestrated campaign at the federal level to make sure that their scientists can't communicate to the public about what they do. Now, that's just his opinion, but I think that's telling coming from a climate scientist in Canada that there is definitely, at the very least, cause for concern about censorship. Okay then, well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Don't censor me.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, you were mentioning earlier about blood.
Yes, yes. A recent court case in Ontario had a man lose a negligent suit against the CBS, which isn't the American Broadcasting Company, but the Canadian Blood Services, because on his questionnaire, he didn't check off the fact that he's a gay male. The question in particular is the prohibitive of men who have had sex with other men any time since 1977. Now, unbeknownst, he'd been given blood for many, many years, but unbeknownst to him, he had contracted and donated a syphilis-infected blood in 2002 and was essentially charged with a cleanup bill of $10,000. Now, the questionnaire itself is rather specific. It says that, you know, if you've had any sex with any man since 1977, you are strictly prohibited from ever, ever donating blood again. But the guy fought this because he saw that as not being very scientific and actually basically being discriminatory against gay donors. And that in essence, that this originally came out of a time, it was originally instigated in 1983 when our understanding of the AIDS epidemic, which happened then, was somewhat, we didn't really understand how it was happening, and the actual testing of blood at the time was very primitive, and that although this was a rather gross method of trying to prevent it from getting into the blood supply, it was needed at the time. But the science has improved quite a lot since then, and in fact, secondary issues have come up about it that have altered the way things go. For example, as far as actually being infected, self-infected with the AIDS, which is the big one, actually 57% are needles related, either using a dirty needle or sharing a needle. 9% are from vaginal intercourse, 33% from anal intercourse, and 1% from oral, apparently. And this is based on a 2005 study. And essentially, everyone is getting upset because the policy hasn't changed. That even in some things, like at one time, Haiti was a really hotbed for HIV, and you weren't allowed to donate if you came from Haiti. But they've changed that because, again, you know, our understanding of science has changed. Italy itself actually has changed its question so that people who have had sexual intercourse with high-risk transmission of STIs, which usually means unprotected sex with multiple partners, or if you've occasionally, which means you've had unprotected sex but maybe with one partner, then you're either excluded permanently if you do it a lot. But the main emphasis, the main change, and why it's discriminatory in Canada is you're not labeling a group for it, but the activity. It's the activity that's done that. For example, if you've been to Africa, right, that's an activity. I go to Africa, and that increases your risk. But we're not saying all Africans are not allowed to donate, which is where we're getting the thing here. Italy, like I say, has changed that. And since it's done that and focused on the activity and not the group, its infection rates from HIV, from blood donations, went from 24 people prior to that in 1999. In 2001, they changed the policy and it fell to 10%. And then it's down to four infections in 2004. right? So the Canadian questionnaire doesn't actually make any reference to risky behavior. So, you know, like I say, it's largely because gay men tend to have anal intercourse more than they have any other kind, that behavior is risky, which is why there is a higher precedence of STDs in the gay community. But, I mean, if you happen to be into that and you're a straight man, right, you're still at the same kind of risk, right?
And did you also say that like 50% of the infections come from shared needle use?
57%, yeah.
I understand that you don't have to be gay to use needles.
Well, you know what's even worse? And again, this is where it almost borders, like I say, it's old school sort of bigotry, I think, in a way. That the questionnaire says that if you had, remember this gentleman was charged with syphilis, right? Okay,
right.
So it says that if you had been treated for syphilis in the last 12 months, you're not allowed to donate, right, for that year.
Sure.
But if it was 13 months, you would be okay. It has needle use was also in there, that if you had sex with someone with needles in the last year, you're not allowed to. But if it was 13 months, it's okay. Whereas for for a gay male, you're never allowed ever to give, period, irrespective of whether you've been tested for AIDS or STDs or what have you. It's just a blanket.
It's problematic because the only fault this man has really committed is not being diligent about finding out whether or not he has an STD.
Well,
that's really the only problem with
well, what makes it worse, and again, this is where the discriminatory aspect comes into it, is that the having sex with gay men wasn't really related. It was the fact he had syphilis, and he didn't know he had syphilis, right? Which is not exactly a gay disease like the other things is.
No.
But they needed some way in order to persecute him for this, or that's the hot way to put this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they took a technicality in part one, which he was guilty of, but I think he was guilty of more for ideological reasons, which caught up to him. Because if Ethan had donated blood and he happened to have syphilis, they wouldn't have charged you for it. Right? Whereas they did get to do it in this guy. Which is, again, I mean, the net result from all this is that one of the big things, and there's a movement to try and change Canada, the US, the UK, it's not unique, it's not universal, but not unique, to change the emphasis from victimizing a group of people to focusing on the activity, the risky activities that's actually at the root of the whole thing.
This is a really good example of how science and skepticism can totally change public policy when applied correctly. And when you, I think, perhaps ignore science in the interest of being ideological, you're really going against the critical thinking, the mindset of the skeptical movement, that is to inform policy based on evidence. And this seems like a perfect perfect area for skeptics to be activists about.
I agree.
Yeah,
if
I also agree.
If these were just, if the questionnaire was informed from science from day one, well, as soon as good evidence and science came out on this subject, then there wouldn't be a problem now. But because of it, there's probably higher rates of infection, and there's a certain discriminatory element in it as well.
Sure.
You know, and actually the one thing that comes out about this is, to point to the scientific method, is when 83 this came out, right? I mean, it was the gay disease, and it was God's curse upon that, right? And I'd like to think that with science evidence, we could move beyond that phase and that everyone should be able to give based upon their merit as opposed to their circumstance.
Certainly, and as technology progresses, we should be updating policy to reflect that as well. So all around, an important skeptical battleground for skeptics and free thinkers. Let's go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinker.
Listen, radio is an important means of communicating 3,000 years of habit in terms of diapering of babies.
Well, please tell me more.
Because radio reaches people, including those hard-to-get young people. Radio goes where they go and talks their language, recognizing the importance of contemporary sound.
And the sounds are instantly recognizable as belonging to the in-groups currently on top of the charts.
CITR, 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
It's wild.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So the main topic today that we've kind of actually been talking about already is diversity in the skeptical movement. So Daniel, tell us about the current state of affairs.
Yeah, last week the UBC Free Thinkers, SFU Skeptics, and the Secular Student Alliance co-hosted some talks. And out on campus, co-hosted two talks by Greta Christina. The one that we're going to sort of talk about and... the one that happened at UBC was titled Diversity in the Atheist Movement. And all of us were here, all the people on the Radio Free Thinker right now, we were there and we all heard it. And we thought it was interesting to talk about some stuff I hadn't really thought of before, but in hindsight kind of makes some sense. And so basically the talk was about how the atheist movement is not doing what it should to ensure that people of minorities and females are as represented in our movement as they should be. If you think of sort of the major spokespeople of the atheist movement, you think of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, of Skeptic, yeah, of Ethan, of the Skeptic movement, people like P.Z. Myers, a bunch of others. Probably most of the people you think of are male and white.
And sometimes they have beards.
And a lot of them have beards.
Like me.
We're limiting ourselves to the good ones.
Oh.
Okay, that was hard.
Sorry.
Anyways, so this is definitely a problem. Public perception matters.
Well, you know, Daniel, I have to ask you then. I mean, I don't know if you've looked in a mirror lately, but you happen to be white and a male. I happen to be white and a male, and Ethan happens to be white and furry. So I mean, what right do we have to even approach this topic? I mean, shouldn't we just back off and say, oh, listen, we're not one of these poor, oppressed minority groups, and we shouldn't do anything about it? Or have I got it all wrong?
What do you think, Chloe?
Thanks. Well, to be honest, the fact that most of the spokespeople for the atheist movement are male, like I can't speak to ethnic minority experience because I'm also white. But the fact that most of the spokespeople in the atheist movement happen to be male doesn't personally bother me. Like it doesn't feel skepticism doesn't feel unapproachable. But I could see why it might for some women. And also, I mean, there is the optics of the situation, and it's easy to level. Things against the atheist movement that be like, oh, it's all composed of white males, that's a bad thing, I'm gonna remove myself from the... Sorry, Daniel, you're raising your hand. Go ahead, Daniel.
You should have finished. I think the whole skeptical way of thinking is it's to ignore who the message is coming from, and it's to like the message, primarily. I mean, sure, we definitely are more likely to accept something by a good scientist we know of, like Richard Dawkins, as opposed to a random preacher or something. But ultimately, we want to look at the evidence and the arguments, not who is saying them. So I think that causes us to be a little blind to this issue, that we kind of ignore it because, personally, I don't like to think that really affects what I believe.
But one of the things that was mentioned in the talk, and everyone sort of said, well, you know, you're not one of the oppressed people, so how can you talk, ignores one of the minor issues, and it's really hard if you're on the upside of this, but any form of discrimination is bidirectional, right? I mean, in order for there to be an oppressed person, there has to be someone who benefits from that oppression. And I think that's where we can have an understanding, and where I think maybe you were kind of glossing over it, maybe, is the fact that, well, one of the reasons why there are so many white males in our popular in the skeptic movement is because being a man in our society has benefits, and in a way, we almost have to give up or acknowledge that we need to be treated almost as second class in order to rectify some of the systematic or institutional discrimination. And you say, well, it doesn't, maybe it really doesn't really exist. But the mere fact that there is such a rampant disproportionality, and one of the things that Greta talked about in her talk was a certain number of percentage, how many people who don't believe in God are male and female, and it works out to be about a 50-50 mix. So you would expect how many people should be in the atheist tour for speakers. You'd think, well, it should be 50-50 or even close. But, I mean, again, you know, Rebecca Watson and I guess maybe Greta, we come up to maybe, you know, 10% are females. So I mean, one part of it is just to acknowledge that there is something there, even if we don't want to believe it's there, because, I mean, the evidence.
I think it's definitely clear there is something to this. I mean, Daniel, like, off the cuff, like, how many women per men are in the UBC Freethinkers, do you think? Like, 25%?
If that? Yeah, probably less than 25% currently, although largely probably because of Chloe and Amanda being at our Imagine Day booths. The people that came up to the booth to talk to us, get on our mailing list, I'd say was pretty close to the male-female split of UBC as a whole.
I don't know if you noticed this, but when we were at the talk, I did a count, and there were about 44 people who were there. Out of the 44, there were about 17 or 18, some of them were dressed rather ambiguously, so I might be off by one or two, male to female. But one of the things that struck me is there were three visible minorities, mm-hmm. right? Two of them were Asian women, one of them was an Iranian man, right? And I'm going, you know, I don't know, does this really reflect our community in any way? And I mean, that struck me as also another spin on this, that just, even though we might think as skeptics, as atheists, that we come to this with sort of an objective, there's no bias involved in there, it seems to be
I think it's clear that there seems to be a problem. I think we can agree that there definitely is an imbalance of visibility of other than white men in the skeptical movement. Mm-hmm. The question, I guess, is how do we fix this, if possible, and what are some of the suggestions that maybe Greta came up with?
Well, she had quite a few suggestions, as well as other people in the audience gave some. I think probably the biggest one, which I guess we're starting to do here, is admitting that there's a problem. you can't really do much until then. And I think just by admitting that this problem exists, you're more likely to get you're more likely to have males do things to be more accepting of females and different minority or the like white people doing more to bring in. And to make people from other cultures and races feel more comfortable.
To be a bit of the pill here, though, but isn't that being a bit paternalistic or, you know, not evangelical, but I mean, you know, oh, we've got a problem here, so the white guy is going to fix it all?
I would say that it doesn't need to be paternalistic. One of the great examples that Greta gave was how on skeptical blogs and that kind of thing, straight people are often more aggressive when it seems like someone else is being homophobic than the gay people on the website. Like, there's a bit more monitoring that comes from the straight community towards other straight community in big scare quotes. So I don't see why white people can't have the same relationship with people of color. Like, we're all, given that we're all skeptics, given that we want to base our lives in reality, the reality is that there is racism and it's all of our jobs to eradicate it.
And to Don's point, I did not mean to say that that us privileged white males are going to save the day or anything.
Dan, I'm saying I was just being a foil, Daniel.
Because we do make up the largest amount of the skeptical community, obviously we're going to have to do something. You can't really have a movement or a whatever you want to call this where the majority of the people in it are like not doing much to bring in.
Sounds good, Daniel. So now I don't feel guilty as being a white male to actively try and change things. What possible things could I try and do to change these things?
Sorry, Daniel, I keep cutting across you. One big issue here, I think, is a linguistic issue. I think the fact that a lot of our literature is in English is part of the problem. I think we would get a lot more minorities into our movement if we started publishing in North America in other languages.
And that's such a chick thing to say.
Is it? How sexist? Leaving. No.
No, but
what do you mean by that? Well,
no, that
it's a skept chick thing to say.
you were using the term language for other nationalities. But I think another thing too is just to be aware that, you know, when we use terms and we say things, that we have to be aware that sometimes, you know, there are, we were talking before about Phil Plait saying people are a dick, and then we had a little discussion about, well, is that a sexist term or not? Because we use the D word, but we wouldn't use, I don't know, the V or C word, depending on where you want to go with that.
Well, that's actually a good point. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that the skeptical community is made up of a lot of, well, nerds, right? We use a lot of in language that people from the outside may not necessarily get. We do, there's a lot of references to things like Star Trek, Star Wars, cultural icons familiar to North American audiences. For someone who comes from a different country or different background, it might seem very intimidating if you don't know what any of these jokes and in references mean.
Yeah, that's definitely true. At the Greta Christina talk, me and a bunch of other people, and I kind of realized this as I was doing this, but we were sort of having a who's a bigger geek, like who loves Star Trek the most kind of discussion going on, which certainly could be alienating to people who otherwise might want to join sort of our group, but they're not Star Trek fans. Actually, I'm not a Star Trek fan, but you get the point.
We're talking about Monty Python too.
Not a fan of Monty Python, and like certainly some, I'll include myself in this, was kind of being condescending on people who aren't Monty Python fans, and it's such a tiny thing. Like, it's not nearly as big as race, but it certainly is going to have an effect. If someone was there and overheard it and was like, well, shoot, I don't think I fit in with these people, then probably going to be less likely to come back.
Exactly.
So I think we had one good thing, that maybe we should be more aware of multicultural, multilinguistic publications. I don't know if Google Docs, Google Translate would translate an entire blog, but that would be, I think that would be kind of interesting to do some experiments, because I don't think I'm going to learn Farsi tomorrow, but Google's already done that for me, and I'm sure if there was a bit of feedback from that community to correct some boo-boos.
Even one option might be to direct members of, say, in Vancouver, we could put links on various blogs to blogs that are written in other languages. Actually, over the weekend, I met the leader of the Tarkshell Indian Rationalist Society that's located in Surrey. Really interesting people. I've been to a couple of their meetings. I couldn't understand it was in Punjabi, but they do a lot of Punjabi skepticism. And so maybe if we were to promote that as an option to members, they'd feel, wow, this community is not just a bunch of white people. It's also a multicultural, literally, movement for rationalism. Same with if we knew blogs that were written from the point of view of, you know, an Asian dialect or from Middle Eastern, African, who knows?
Do you know what would be a great project for us or maybe someone else to do is actually to set up a website that would just be, you know, the Global Skeptic, and it just be an accumulation of links to other blogs with the intention of being multicultural, multilinguistic, just so there'd be one repository. One, it would allow someplace to go and say, well, I'm skeptic, but my first language happens to be Cantonese. Where can I find one? You can go there. But two, it would be a perk, because I'm sure, as a skeptic myself, if I went to this place and I saw that there was like millions and millions of different blogs from different languages, that would make it seem far more global, and I wouldn't be just us poor people here in Vancouver alone, or Surrey, or what have you.
Right. Why don't we take a break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more on the discussion of diversity in the skeptical movement.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. We're talking about diversity in the skeptical movement. Let's talk about some real concrete solutions that we can do here.
In Greta's talk, she mentioned one really tiny thing that I thought was kind of interesting. Skeptics need to have T-shirts not only in male sizes. It seems like such a tiny little thing, but it's more of like a metaphor of a deeper problem that we try and have this one-size-fits-all thing, whereas women or other minorities are going to have different needs. And, Yeah, so next time there's a Skepta camp, we need some female-sized shirts.
Well, not just female-sized, but female cut, you know, like a blouse as opposed to a golf shirt. Which
yeah,
is...
that's sort of what I was getting at by my horrible vocabulary. But another one, we sort of talked about this, but we all need to attack sexism, racism, bigotry of any kind. And she did mention how, for the most part, we're pretty good against attacking bigotry against the gay community. But we can be bad at attacking sexism. I'd say we're probably decent at attacking racism, but sexism, at least not super, super obvious sexism, we might not do much. And she gave an example. I think it was PZ Myers on his blog. He talked about how he had to go in for surgery.
That's right, it was PZ.
Yeah, PZ Myers. And a lot of people were hoping that he had sexy nurses, which you could easily take as sort of an objectifying a general female position that, I mean, you should really be hoping that he has nurses who are competent in science and medicine.
Yeah.
But instead, people are saying that they should just be sexy. And it's a small thing. No one's accusing these people of being horribly sexist, but as she was saying, some females might look at this and be turned off from fitting in with the group as a whole.
You know, and going on with this, and you mentioned it. You mentioned about racism too, right? I mean, we talked about this earlier. Where one of the things we have to be careful of is that there are, in theory, just as many Arab or East Indian atheists as there are. I mean, in fact, we had an excellent sort of example of East Indian skepticism with the faith healer, was it? Or what was they had a $10,000 prize.
Yeah, that was the Tarkshell Society offered $100,000 for anyone who could prove that they had, like, supernatural psychic abilities.
Right. So when we're talking about with atheism in particular, I mean, I can think of the guy from Young Turks, Zink, I think his name is, or Zerk, or whatever. I think he's East Indian descent, whatever, right? But I mean, if you were an atheist and you were heard skeptics like us say, well, you know, we should ban the mosque in New York and the Koran burning is maybe okay, and then that gets associated with people who are hardcore racist, you can understand how they might be less willing to come out and support us because the message gets confused from the atheist versus the racist. And
right, and that's also kind of getting to the point that Greta mentioned about choosing battles that will resonate with people who are trying to attract the skeptical movement. And like we were just talking about the blood issue with both Canadian blood services, that's an issue that by all accounts should be front center for the skeptical mandate. And it's also going to send a message to, I think, gay, lesbian members of the skeptical community that these are issues that we as skeptics care about. And I think we've talked about political skepticism on the show before. These are issues that I think we need to do a better job of addressing.
And a great example, too, is we had the Quran burning, which some atheists say, hey, no problem burning religious texts. Draw Muhammad Day, which is, you know, now these may, in purity, be valid atheistic acts. But because they've been so soiled by other things, that these are battles we don't want to fight. We just want to say, look, we have to walk away because there is so much more negative fallout from this that's going to hurt our movement in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other suggestions that might be out there?
Oh, another thing she suggested was basically affirmative action within the atheist community. So, for instance, for, say, our club, making sure that some exec positions are filled by females. I like to say I did a good job. I basically forced Amanda to be on the exec team, so go me. But I think Ethan and I, we should immediately step down from our positions and give them over to females or racial minorities.
There was one other thing, too, that Greta had talked about, and I think this is sometimes hard in a way. I forget who it was now, but he's one of the big members of the skeptic community in Vancouver here, talked about how they were trying to organize a conference, I think it was TAM, and yeah, they had sent out 10 emails to get female speakers or minority speakers out there, and they might have only got one or two responses, and even those weren't really positive. And Greta essentially said, well, tough, then why send out 20, send out 30? You know, just because you made some effort doesn't always mean that's enough of an effort, and that if there is this sort of systemic or institutional sort of bias in society, you sometimes have to work really, really, really hard to get over it.
She did really stress persevering, which I thought was great. I mean, she gave the example of the LGBT movement still dealing with issues of racism and sexism that were at the inception of the LGBT movement, mostly gay white males, et cetera, et cetera. And she made an important point. If we get rid of these problems now, then they won't bite us in the... I don't know if I'm allowed to... But that's a nice radio-friendly word 20 years down the road.
For those people in France, ass. Just to translate. But actually, no, and you bring up a good thing, because, I mean, one of the things that's been a curse of the gay community is you have black gay men, or you have lesbians, and they're not gay, they're black gay, or they're women who happen to be like other women. Whereas we don't want to have that. I mean, the first thing you should be is an atheist or a skeptic, right? And then if you happen to be a woman or you happen to be a minority, that's not the defining feature. Whereas, like I say, in the gay community, it tends to be your gender or your race that's the defining thing, and then you have this other add-on.
Right, and we already actually are kind of segregating the grander movement. We already have people who are only atheists, people who are only skeptics, people who are only new atheists, and some people who are only old school atheists, whatever that means. So, I mean, we don't need to divide it further up and to have, like, women new atheists versus black skeptics only type stuff, right?
Yeah, that, it's just ridiculous. Like, we want to be as accepting as possible. I mean, obviously, we're probably not going to accept, like, a devout Catholic for obvious reasons. It's just entirely against what we believe. But we shouldn't trifle over small little details.
Mm-hmm. On that topic, and I'm not sure how much more we have to go on this issue, but is there any examples of diversity in the skeptic or atheist community that we might highlight in the show just to show that there are multiple voices out there that have value?
Well, I happen to have that information right here, Don. One fantastic example, my opinion, of an important member of the skeptical community is Neil deGrasse Tyson. Some of you may be familiar with... I think he's been on, like, Bill Nye a couple of times, but that isn't exactly his most important achievement. Born and raised in New York, BA in physics at Harvard, PhD in astrophysics at Columbia, author of a number of books, including Death by Black Hole, holder of 12 honorary doctorates, winner of NASA Distinguished Public Service Award, sexiest astrophysicist alive, according to People magazine. I didn't know they had that, but whatever. And he's very, very vocal about lack of evidence for God. One of my favorite, this isn't necessarily related to that particular aspect of Neil deGrasse Tyson's quotes, but this is a great quote of his which I love. I know that the molecules in my body are traceable to phenomena in the cosmos. That makes me want to grab people in the street and say, have you heard this? Another great, important, this is actually a blogger, Hemant Mehta, the person who blogs at Friendly Atheist, graduated from the University of Illinois at Chicago with a degree in mathematics. He has a fantastic blog, by the way. I recommend that everyone check that out if they haven't already.
That's right.
I'm sure they have.
And
there's also Skeptchick, Rebecca Watson.
Skeptchick, of course. There's Jennifer Michael Hecht, who wrote Doubt a History, which arguably might have started the new atheist movement. There's, in fact, recently CFI had Christopher DiCarlo give a talk about the shared African heritage of everybody here. There's really, I think we could probably come up with a huge list of people. I think the question is, are these people considered at the forefront of the skeptical community, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the question.
And there's the other thing, too, is you used before skeptics and atheists, and sometimes the two don't cross over.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm reminded of a weird anecdote. This is sort of by left field, but it struck me as hilarious how some people are just out of it in their own way. There was a discussion going on in City Hall. I think it was in America, Chicago, maybe it was a smaller town, that someone was complaining about how they're throwing money down a black hole. And this one MP came up, yelled and says, "What? Why do you say it's a black hole? What are you, some kind of a racist?"
I remember that.
it just struck me as absolutely hilarious, and how, you know, some people can become too politically correct, which we have to worry about as well. But I think, I don't know, just as long as we are willing to make that effort, that we're willing to be open and keep our eyes aware that, one, as white males, as white women, as what have you, we have certain privileges and we have to be aware of that. We can't be patronizing, but just aware that there is sometimes more onus on us to do things than not. And be aware that there is a problem and work together to be more, I don't know, diverse, you know,
inclusive.
Everybody, need somebody.
Well, certainly. I mean, like, one of the takeaway messages that I got from reading Carl Sagan's books and watching Cosmos was this link between skepticism and tolerance and democracy and including everybody. And, you know, if we leave one person behind in that demon-haunted world, you know, we've failed. So I think the skeptical movement, absolutely, it is pivotal to our success that we have to include and make an effort to reach out to everyone, even people who we think might be a lost cause.
Well, you know, and there's also the practical aspect of it, right? I mean, you know, we have a big problem sort of as a nation with Iraq and Iran and all that, and there are lots of complex issues with that. But one of the things that can bridge some of these other issues is that, I mean, we can all sort of agree on skepticism, right? And if we reach out to people in these minority communities, and then they increase the bonds, the ties, and it strengthens our movement by this diversity.
Exactly.
For the record, as the only female skeptic in the room, I would just like to say that I feel very, very comfortable in the skeptical movement, and I feel that the men in the movement are very respectful because they base their views on reality, and the reality is that women are people. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Well, I've heard
what?
This.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time here on the show. Let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, you seem very eager to talk first.
Well, I don't have a lot to say, but this seems to be the most, as far as we're talking about diversity and all that, it's an alternative source for news or whatever. It's something I came across a while ago. You have to be careful with it. Any news source has its bias. Every so often they go on the conspiracy side, a little bit of the woo-woo. But by and large, they offer a unique and different view of the world and politics in particular from the mainstream media. The website is www.pacifica.ca. That's spelled PASIFIK.ca. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit collective concerned with developing direct democracy. So they had some very interesting things about democratic process, just alternative views of the way the world works. And the more information you have for the more diverse things, the better views you won't have, even if they're not as good as some people. Daniel, do you have one?
Wow, really? That wasn't even subtle. The UBC Freethinkers have our monthly Breakfast of Champions coming up. If you like great breakfast, great conversations, great people, and we're very inclusive. We welcome everyone. Please come. It'll be this Sunday, September 19th, starting at 10:30 a.m. at Café du Soleil.
Does it really end at 7 p.m.?
No, I don't know why Amanda put 7 p.m. It will not last, 9 hours.
But it could.
Well,
it could.
It's 9 hours if you like.
For all we know, we'll end up at the railway club. That's sure. How it usually works. and also, I just wanted to mention that the UBC Freethinkers have a new blog up. It looked a lot nicer than the old one, and we actually updated it. It's ubcfreethinkers.wordpress.com.
Excellent.
And come see us at Clubs Days. Proselytizing doesn't come naturally to us, so please come and ask us questions at our booth if you're on campus at UBC.
Good. Well, I have a skeptical highlight as well. CFI is presenting Cafe Inquiry on Saturday, September 18th at SFU Harbor Center in room 1600. This will be at 11 a.m., and this cafe will be an experiment on deliberative democracy. So it's going to be very interactive. Sounds like a lot of fun. I encourage you to come out. It's going to be very interesting.
Deliberative democracy. So you're going to deliberately be democratic, or what?
Well, so I guess I can let the cat out of the bag on this one. We're going to pretend that we're trapped on a desert island and we only have limited resources for a few people. So we're going to decide who will benefit society most. Who should we kick off, and who should stay? So it's going to be very interesting. And lots of potential for questions of diversity to arise and get very heated. So definitely come out and watch the sparks fly. I want to remind our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to Radio Free Thinker on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. You can also become fans of us on Facebook, which is very important. And if you have any emails, questions, comments, criticisms, or anything else, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And of course, you can read our blog and all the show notes at www.radiofreethinker.com.
You know, I have a bit of a shout out for Rob, because I believe the Pope is visiting England, isn't he, this week or something like that? And I wonder if, Rob, if you're listening to our show and now that you are in England, you might have something for us out there, or if someone else in England who happens to listen to our podcast can send us some notes about English reaction to that.
Okay, well, there we go. That was a great way to end the show. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Daniel saying I still haven't thought of something to say.
Neither have I. This is Chloe.
All right, bye-bye, folks.
Then there's the utter misery that is...